Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Gail Godwin takes a look at the publishing industry over the last 50 years, a time of great upheaval and ingenuity in her new memoir, Publishing. Godwin is a three-time National Book Award finalist and is the best-selling author of 14 novels, including Flora, Evensong, and The Good Husband. In her latest, she reflects on her experiences with Iowa Writers' Workshop teachers such as Kurt Vonnegut and Robert Coover, as well as writer friends like John Irving and John Hawkins, her literary agent for five decades. It is a great pleasure to welcome Gail Godwin to The Book Show. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure always to come here.
You have a wonderful sense of the process of writing. I find that many writers like to write and they don't talk about how the sausage is made a lot. You have journaled about this. You have written about being an author. And here you write about publishing and your experiences over the past 50 years. And it's really fascinating because the business side is a huge side.
Huge.
Of your profession.
Yes.
How much of that were you aware going into it?
Not very much. I went into it in 1970. That's when I got allowed through the portals of publishing. And at that time, it was just about the end of the old gentleman's club type publishing. Most of the publishing companies were still named after the people who founded them. There's Alfred Knopf, and then there's Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster and Mr. Nelson Doubleday, and, you know, you go on down.
Putnam and Harper and Putnam, Rowe and all those.
Yeah, yeah. Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, you know, they're all people. It wasn't until, actually, 13 years later that I started seeing everything falling apart around me, mostly falling apart for people in publishing, like editors and publishers.
And we'll talk about this, yeah. but this falling apart is sort of the last chapter, because really people would look at your experience and coming in the 1970s and saying, oh, well, when I published in the 1950s and 1960s, mm-hmm. it was nothing like it is, you know, at that point.
Right.
It had started its decline.
Or whatever it was. I'm still trying to figure out what it was. It was as if it was the thing called publishing was becoming a new kind of creature, and it didn't know what it was, and the internet was looming. We still have a way to go, but I have some ideas. I've been thinking about it.
Your idea of wanting to be a writer and taking it to the next level. And I say it that way because you talk about in the book a very specific moment of where you say, well, if you're going to take your writing seriously. Mm-hmm. So that was a conscious choice, really, for you to say, okay, I'm going to take my writing seriously. Mm-hmm. To do that, you did what?
Well, of course, I'd been writing all those years, but also having to make a living and traveling around to countries. But a friend that I met in Copenhagen went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop first. Her name was Lorraine O'Grady. And she said, come out here and get serious about your writing. And so I had just written a story for the London City Literary Institute, which was an evening class for creative writing. And I sent that to her, and she took it to the man who either lets you in the workshop or not. And he said, well, your friend has some kinks, but we can get them out of her. Mm. So I flew to Iowa.
There became a mantra, which was
obscurity.
So what do I risk? Obscurity?
Yeah, I love that.
And that came from Lorraine.
It came from
she had heard it.
Yes, she had. Then I went to the workshop, and Lorraine was in another section of the workshop. And she said, you should have been there today. I can't remember the woman's name, but this girl had had her story critiqued. And they all said, it's too obscure. Nobody will understand it. And she stood up and she said, so what do I risk? Obscurity? And that has given me such hope over the years. Sometimes those negative things will really work out. I remember reading in a piece by Isaac Dennison right before she died, Karen Blixen. It was in an Atlantic Monthly, and I was on the bus, and she was giving advice to young writers, and she said, if you can just keep going without hope, she said, without hope is the secret. And that's another, so cheerful, you know, just like, so what do I risk? Obscurity?
There are wonderful moments. I just have to add this as a little bit of a tangent, but in writing about this, you say, I've tried to recall her name. You're talking about a workshop student. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I would have written it in my journal along with the famous obscurity quote, but that particular journal was thrown into the Iowa River by a jealous boyfriend determined to destroy everything that came before him.
He did.
That's a wonderful sidebar.
Right. And plus the fact that the girl who said it, that I don't know, I can see her so clearly. She looks so much like Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, on MSNBC.
Yeah, sure. without the smile. This girl never smiled.
But in your writing and in this book, there are some fond recollections as well.
Fond and witty and subtle. And a few places where the knife is turned subtly. I've tried to make it subtle.
So let's talk about the workshops, because we have to get to your work with Kurt Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. He was running one of the workshops. You were one of the students. How long is a session with Kurt Vonnegut? How long are you with an individual working?
Well, you have the public workshop, which is about 20 people in the room. He was so in demand that he agreed to have two workshops. So he had actually 40 students. And we would meet once a week as our 20 number. And then he would see you if you had something, if you'd written something and he'd read it, he would spend an hour with you. He was very laid back and he was very kind. He somehow made you feel less threatened.
The one thing that you write about him, which I've heard from other writers as well, is that you say that he wasn't trying to make a bunch of little Vonneguts.
No. He had such respect for what an individual writer did. He said to me once, I don't think you have it in you to be crude. What I do is I write with a big black crayon. He was just making a statement that we came at things in a different way. Mm. But he respected mine, and I certainly adored his.
And he would say, you would present a story and say, maybe this could be a novel. And yeah. He said, no, maybe not. And you decided to go in that way anyway.
And that's right. And he said, great idea. He was with you.
You tell the story almost as an example of how other people that you worked with were not as giving and forthcoming.
No, they either really would rather be off doing their own thing, duck hunting or flying around to conferences, or they wanted you to jump on the postmodern bandwagon.
Talk a little bit about the postmodern bandwagon. How was it being described to you as a student at that time in the late 1960s?
It was very seductive, and I was so unhappy sometimes because I knew it wasn't for me. There were a lot of little fashionable asides. For instance, some of the writing students would carry those computer punch-out cards and do their writing on that. Mm-hmm. And even Robert Coover had those cards. One student was so excited because she had found a new way to write. She would write something on a piece of paper, like a whole page, and then tear it up in little bits and then throw it up in the air and see where it landed and then copy that out. And I thought it was ridiculous, but I was also enraged that that this was being taken seriously. It was being taken seriously. Mm. To break up everything and have it reshaped.
And they were looking at you sometimes and your work as the old way, if you will.
No, actually, they didn't. I wrote some peculiar stories for that, actually for that one workshop with Coover. The first story I wrote for him was about a young woman, graduate student, she studied too hard and she breaks an egg. She's going to make an omelet and turns out it's a dragon and she tries to raise it in her little apartment. And he liked that one. And then I wrote another one called A Sorrowful Mother, and it was just about a woman who retreated and retreated and retreated as far as she could go. And he thought that was marvelous. He said, "You've taken this subject as far as it can go." And so then my agent sent it around in New York, and Gordon Lish, who had just come to Esquire, said, "I'd like to publish this, but I'd like to make a few changes." He said, "I'll send her my changes." So Lish sent me these changes, and I said to my agent, "Half of it is gone. He's taken out all the dreams of this woman." And then Lish said, "It'll make her more inscrutable." So I caved on that occasion, and I'm paying for it to this day. If you Google Gail Godwin, A Sorrowful Woman, you will get pages and pages, offers of theses that can be written for you, school papers, $35, $45. And I get lots of email from students who say, "Look, I don't want you to try to do my paper for me, but is this woman crazy or what? Could you just tell me what's wrong with her?" One young man even did a movie of it, which you can get on.
Online?
Yeah, somewhere. Online. Just put in A Sorrowful Woman.
Did you ever go back and say, "Okay, this is what I want it to be? This is the way I want it to be"? Would it be something you'd ever rewrite?
Much later, I was trying to find a copy of the old one because it was about the time, maybe 20 years later, when Raymond Carver's widow was republishing all of his stories with Gordon Lish's cuts put back in. And so my agent said, "Oh, I wish you had that old story." But I couldn't find it.
We are talking to Gail Godwin. Her new book is Publishing, A Writer's Memoir. It is published by Bloomsbury. You spoke a moment ago about your agent, John Hawkins, for 50 years.
Yeah.
What is it like to find someone like that who really has to know you and know your work and know the business really better than anybody? It seems like that it's almost like finding a life partner, really, of finding someone who is going to understand you, understand your work, that it really is an awful lot of great luck if you find someone who that you want to be with for that period of time.
I've used the analogy during the book. This came from another editor of mine, Alan Williams, who said that the writer and the editor, they are in a sort of partnership, in a sort of dance. And I've used that metaphor of dance partners. I think I've had 9 in all. John was not exactly a dance partner. John was very keen in business. He had gone to Harvard Business School. His real desire was to be a countertenor, and he'd studied in Paris. But then he realized he'd better find something to do, something in business. But he loved writers and loved publishing. But he saved me from a great number of big mistakes. And he would start auctions, and I'd say, "Oh, nobody's going to bid on this." But then they would. Not everybody can do that. I mean, it used to worry me. Mm. I would say, "Well, what if nobody bids?" And he'd say, "Well, they will." And then if one bids, the others want it, and they want you as their literary number on their list. And A Mother and Two Daughters did so well, so you have that. And they just want to fight with each other, so it's better to do it this way. I'm not sure that's still right today.
You write in the book, "When recalling today that 7 major New York houses were bidding for my book, while Robert, the composer with whom I shared my life, and I were crossing on the ferry to Ocracoke, I feel there are still 3 of me in one skin, and none of us can quite believe it. There is the author on the ferry on her way to revisit the island where A Mother and 2 Daughters will reach its denouement, which she hasn't written yet. There is the unpublished student chanting Anglo-Saxon poetry on her solitary walk home under the Iowa stars. and there is the present me who sits here at the keyboard in Woodstock in the house that was built on the bounty that had its beginnings on that day.
You always pick such good parts.
That's a beautiful part.
Thank you.
To have that moment where you have people fighting over you, who's going to publish you, really, and realizing, oh, okay, this is who I am, this is what I have to do now, mm-hmm. and then to be able in this fashion, in this book, to reflect on it seems like a great treat.
Some part of me still doesn't believe it. I look at my house and I think this house was built for my writing, and it still seems mysterious to me. It still seems like a little bit of a fairy tale, but it happened.
I want to go back to something because I find it interesting. You had this wonderful partnership with John Hawkins as your agent. Editors were harder for you.
Mm-hmm.
Some writers have the same editor for years and years. Mm-hmm. That was not you. Do you have a sense of why that was?
I've tried to figure it out. Let's see, some bad luck. The first one died. He died actually before my book was published, but he had bought an option or had a contract on my second book, David Siegel. And then my next one I stayed with for 9 years, and then the auction happened. And then publishing started changing. I thought, well, here I am at Viking. This is going to be good. And then it was 1983. And I had one book out with them, another one about to turn in, and John Hawkins called. And he always had these different things he would say, like, have you heard? Or we're up the creek. And it would mean that some CEO had come in and fired everybody. So I didn't have an editor or I didn't have a publisher. And this kept happening. In fact, when I was at Random House Ballantyne, my editor, who was also my publisher, Linda Gray, was fired on the day of my book publication. So there was a lot of that. The only one I actually left was Bob Gottlieb, and he was in on the bidding for A Mother and Two Daughters, because I wanted to see if I could get more money so I could take 2 years off from teaching and then write and then go back, and I couldn't. For the amount he was offering. So that's why John told me to have an auction, and we did.
Mm. When you look at that time where publishing changed, because you even talk about Linda Gray and her demise at Random House as sort of being the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it was. And there was a little one before that with the Viking when all of them were fired. And then I lived in Woodstock, and our neighbor was Peter Mayer, who had just done all the firing. And so we were asked to lunch that very weekend. And I was determined not to mention all the firings. I thought that would be very social of me not to mention it. But I met the new men who were taking over in England, and one had just come from Price Waterhouse. And the new man who was going to be at Viking that Peter hired had made his name in toys, manufacturing of toys. And I realized things were changing. And when Robert and I got home that day from the lunch, I said, you know, I think you really have to start worrying when the CEOs themselves are worried about pleasing someone higher up the ladder about making that bottom line. And it was like that from then on.
So jump to today, where you have Viking, now Penguin, owning Random House, and that being one big company. Uh-huh. And which is a long way of asking the question of, in all of this, and of merging and moving and companies coming in and folks from toy companies and Price Waterhouse, mm-hmm. working in the publishing industry, how does it ultimately affect you as a writer?
It affects how much I think I can ask for, and it also affects how I go about managing the financial part of my life. Now, in the old days, in fact, right up until Flora, which was published in 2013, I always asked for an advance before I began my next novel. And that's how I lived. And now I'm willing to live on less and finish a novel or a book. I finished Flora and then I finished publishing without showing it to anybody. And the novel I'm working on now, it's the same way. It's just I'm a lot more careful because I know things are different. And I know there's not going to be seven publishing houses dying for me or being over the moon to have me. So I'm being much more cautious, and I'm also thinking of things I would like to suggest when it comes time to offer my next book. And one of the things I think would make a great difference if publishers were willing to publish more quality books as beautiful paperbacks. Mm. If you're going to sell a book for $12, that's different from $24.95. I think that would be a great difference. The other thing I cannot do much about, because I'm not a corporate person, why is it that publishing is the only business I can think of that allows returns? You know, the clothing business, you order your clothes for your shop, and what doesn't sell, you mark down, you mark it down, you mark it down again. These gents don't have to go on doing this. They're not gents anymore, so they don't have to go on doing this. They can just not have returns. It bothers everybody.
So if I'm a store and I buy 20 copies, then I'd be stuck with 20 copies instead of returning 12 of them at 45% or 48% or whatever.
It would take a little bit more thinking, but it would be a lot easier. The bookkeeping would be a lot easier because they take, for authors, they take off when you get your payments and your royalty statements, they reserve a certain amount of thousands and thousands for possible returns. So you're just waiting and waiting and waiting.
So let me conclude with a question that
this has been all about money. I'm sorry.
Now I'll get to the art stuff.
Good. Let's do that.
Because my question is, and I realize it's probably impossible to answer, but do you see a difference? Does it impact? Does this business side of it impact the art, impact the writing in any way that you can see, the product, the book that we read? And would you be able to tell that versus just the natural maturation of an author?
I think what you're asking is, as I'm writing and as I'm having this deep relationship with material in progress, is what's happening out in the publishing world influencing me in any way? The
work,
no. No, in fact, less and less.
So there's a separation of church and state
there.
Yeah,
but to do that, you have to go back to that old "so what do I risk" obscurity motto and say, look, I have this much time left. I want to do this, this, and this, and I'm simply not going to compromise. I'm going to write it the way I want it, and then when I finish it, I'll let someone see it. So I don't think about it at all. I just feel very quiet and happy in that room by myself.
And that is more, I assume that's where the magic happens. The other stuff can happen, and that's not the fun part of the job.
The selling of my books and the branding yourself, I just hate that. But you have to do a certain part of it. But the part I love is when I'm writing something that contains a whole lot of subjects that I care about, or I'm fascinated by, or I'm scared of, then I'm right where it is. I'm right there.
Well, Gail Godwin's new book is publishing. It is published by Bloomsbury. Gail Godwin, it's always a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for sharing time with us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our programs. You can email us, book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.